This program is copyright 1995 by National Vanguard Books. Post Office Box 330, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946. All rights reserved.
This is no time for womanly hand-wringing. This lesson was brought home forcefully to all of us by what we saw on the TV news this evening. The Human Relations Council in Chicago organized a huge anti-racism rally today. The purported excuse for the rally was to protest the machine gunning of a carload of black deputies Friday in downtown Chicago in broad daylight, presumably by the organization. Only three blacks were killed in the incident, but the system seized on it in order to squelch the seething white resentment against the Human Relations Councils and their deputized black goon squads. Apparently, these black deputies have perpetrated even more shocking outrages against defenseless whites in Chicago than they have around here. The Chicago rally, which was vigorously promoted by all the mass media in the Chicago area, involved nearly 200,000 demonstrators in its initial stage, more than half of them whites. Hundreds of special buses, contributed by the city transit authorities, brought in people from all the suburbs for the occasion. Thousands of young black thugs, wearing the armbands of the Chicago Human Relations Council, strutted arrogantly through the huge mob, maintaining order. The rally was addressed by all the usual political prostitutes and pulpit prostitutes who issued pious calls for brotherhood and equality. Then the system trotted out one of their local toms who gave a rousing speech about stamping out the evil of white racism once and for all. Here is another editorial note to the reader. A tom was a Negro frontman for the authorities or for Jewish interests. Experts at manipulating the masses of their own race, they were paid well for their services. Some toms were even employed briefly by the organization during the final stages of the revolution, when it was desired to flush millions of Negroes out of certain urban areas into holding camps with a minimum loss of white lives. Now we return to the text. After that, the skilled agitators of the Human Relations Council worked various sections of the crowd up into a real brotherhood frenzy. These swarthy, kinky-haired little Jew boys with transistorized megaphones really know their business. They had the mob screaming with real bloodlust for any white racist who might be unfortunate enough to fall into their hands. Chanting, "Kill the racists," and other expressions of brotherly love, the mob began a march through downtown Chicago. Shoppers, workers, and businessmen on the sidewalks were ordered by the black deputies to join the march. Anyone who refused was beaten without mercy. Then gangs of blacks began going into the stores and office buildings along the march route, using bullhorns to order everyone out into the street. Usually it was only necessary to kick one or two stubborn whites into a senseless, bloody pulp before the rest of the occupants of a department store or building lobby got the idea and enthusiastically joined the demonstration. As the crowd swelled, approaching a half million persons toward the end, the blacks with the armbands became more and more belligerent. Any white in the crowd who looked as if he weren't chanting loudly enough was likely to be attacked. And there were several particularly vicious incidents which the TV cameras gloatingly zoomed in on. Someone in the crowd started the rumor that a bookstore they were approaching sold racist books. Within a minute or two, a group of several hundred demonstrators, mostly young whites this time, had split off from the main crowd and converged on the bookstore. Windows were smashed, and teams of demonstrators inside the store began hurling armloads of books to others outside. After an initial flurry of rage was dissipated by wildly tearing hands full of pages from the books and throwing them into the air, a bonfire was started on the sidewalk for the rest of the books. Then they dragged out a white sales clerk and began beating him. He fell to the pavement, and the mob surged over him, stomping and kicking. The television screen showed a close-up of the scene. The faces of the white demonstrators were contorted with hatred for their own race. Another incident in which the TV viewers were treated to close-up coverage was the killing of a cat. A large white alley cat was spotted by someone in the crowd who started to cry, "Get the honky cat!" About a dozen demonstrators took off down an alley after the unfortunate cat. When they reappeared a few moments later, holding up the bloody carcass of the cat, an exultant cheer went up from those in the crowd near enough to see what had happened. Sheer insanity. It is impossible to put into words how depressed we all are by the spectacle in Chicago. That, of course, was the aim of the organizers of the rally. They are expert psychologists, and they thoroughly understand the use of mass terror for intimidation. They know that millions of people who still oppose them inwardly will now be too frightened to open their mouths. But how could our people, how could white Americans be so spineless, so crawling, so eager to please their oppressors? How can we recruit a revolutionary army from such a rabble? Is this really the same race that walked on the moon and was reaching for the stars 20 years ago? How low we have been brought. It's frighteningly clear now that there is no way to win the struggle in which we are engaged without shedding torrents, veritable rivers of blood. The carload of carrion we left in Alexandria Saturday was mentioned briefly on the local news, but not at all on the national news. The reason for the downplay, I suspect, is not that sextuple killings have become too commonplace to be noteworthy, but that the authorities recognized the racial significance of the thing and decided not to encourage imitation. The next diary entry is dated December 4th, 1991. I went over to Georgetown today to talk to Elsa, the little red-headed dropout I met a couple of weeks ago. The reason for my visit was to try to make a better evaluation of the potential of some of Elsa's friends for playing a role in our fight against the system. Actually, some of them, or at least people in similar circumstances, already are involved in their own war against the system. In the last month, there's been a bewildering proliferation of incidents in which the organization has not been involved. These have included bombings, arson, kidnapping, violent public demonstrations, sabotage, death threats against prominent figures, even two widely publicized assassinations. Credit for the various incidents has been claimed by so many different groups, anarchists, tax rebels, liberation fronts of one stripe or another, half a dozen far-out religious cults, that no one can keep up with at all. Every nut with an axe to grind seems to have gotten into the act. Most of these people are such careless amateurs that even our racially integrated FBI has been doing a fairly creditable job of rounding them up. But more seem to keep cropping up. The general atmosphere of revolutionary violence and government counter-violence that the organization's activities have brought on is apparently responsible for encouraging most of them. The most interesting aspect of all this is the proof it represents that the system's grip on the minds of the citizenry is less than total. Most Americans, of course, are still marching in mental lockstep with the high priests of the TV religion. But a growing minority have broken step and regard the system as an enemy. Unfortunately, their hostility is usually based on the wrong reasons, and it would be nearly impossible to coordinate their activities. In fact, in the great majority of cases, there is no reasoned basis at all for their activity. It's really just a massive venting of frustration in the form of vandalism rather than political terrorism. They just want to smash something, to inflict some injury on the people they see as responsible for the unlivable world they are forced to live in. Vandalism on the massive scale we are seeing now is something with which the political police simply cannot continue to cope for very long. It's running them ragged. Besides the political vandals and the loonies, Two other segments of the population have been playing an important role in recent events: the black separatists and the organized criminals. Until a few weeks ago, everyone assumed that the system had finally bought off the last of the nationalist-minded blacks back in the 1970s. Apparently, they have just been lying low and minding their own business, and now they see a chance to get a few licks in. Mostly, they seem to have been blowing up the offices of Tom groups and shooting each other. But they organized a pretty good riot in New Orleans last week, in which there was a lot of window breaking and looting. More power to them. The mafia, two or three of the big labor unions they own, and a couple of other organized crime groups have been capitalizing on the disorder and the public apprehension by substantially stepping up their extortion activities. When they tell a businessman or a merchant that they'll bomb his place of business unless he coughs up a protection payment, they're more likely to be believed than they were a few months ago. And kidnapping has become a big business. The cops are too busy working on things the system is really worried about, namely us, to bother the professional thugs, and they're having a field day. Taking a strictly cold-blooded view, we must welcome even this upsurge in crime, since it helps to undermine the confidence of the public in the system. But the day must also come when we will take every one of these elements, which the system's bought judges have coddled for so long, and put them up against the wall without further ado, along with the judges. I knocked at the address Elsa gave me. It is the basement entrance of what was once an elegant townhouse. And when I asked for Elsa, I was invited in by an obviously pregnant young woman with a bawling infant in her arms. When my eyes adjusted to the dim light, I saw that the whole basement is being used as a communal living area. Blankets and sheets tied to the pipes which run along the low ceiling serve to crudely partition off half a dozen corners and niches as semi-private sleeping areas. In addition, there are several mattresses on the floor in the main portion of the basement. Other than a card table next to the laundry sink, where two young women were washing some cooking utensils, there is no furniture, not even a chair. Against one wall, there is an ancient wood-burning stove, which gives off the only heat in the basement. As I learned later, running water is the only public utility which the little commune has at its disposal, and they obtain fuel for their stove by scavenging in the neighborhood or by sending a raiding party upstairs to break up doors, banisters, window jams, even floorboards. Another, larger commune occupies the upper portions of the house, beyond the heavily barricaded steel door at the head of the basement stairs, but they often indulge in wild drug parties, after which they are in no condition to repel fuel raiders from downstairs. The basement dwellers shun hard drugs and regard themselves as quite superior to the upstairs people. They nevertheless prefer the grubby basement for themselves because it is easier to heat and easier to defend than upstairs, the only windows being a few tiny dirt-streaked panes near the ceiling, far too small to admit any hostile intruder. In addition, it's cooler in the summer. Seven or eight of them were sprawled on mattresses, watching some inane game program on a battery-powered television receiver and smoking marijuana cigarettes when I entered. The whole place was permeated by the stink of stale beer, unwashed laundry, and marijuana smoke. They don't regard marijuana as a drug. Two small boys, about 4 years old, both stark naked, were rolling on the floor and fighting near the stove. A gray cat, perched comfortably on one of the idle heating pipes near the ceiling, stared down at me curiously. The people on the mattresses, though, after a brief glance, paid no further attention to me. I could see that none of the faces illuminated by the TV screen was Elsa's. When the girl who had admitted me called out her name, however, one of the blanket partitions in a far corner was suddenly thrust aside, and Elsa's head and bare shoulders became momentarily visible. She squealed with delight when she saw me, ducked back behind her blanket, and emerged a moment later in her granny dress. I was vaguely disturbed to catch a glimpse of another form on the mattress in the dim recess as Elsa parted the blanket and came out. A twinge of jealousy? Elsa gave me a quick hug of genuine affection and then offered me a cup of steaming coffee, which she poured from a battered pot on the stove. I gratefully accepted the coffee, for the walk from the bus stop had thoroughly chilled me. We sat on an unoccupied mattress near the stove. The sound from the TV and the noise being made by the crying baby and the two scuffling boys allowed us to talk in relative privacy. We talked of many things, for I didn't want to blurt out immediately the true reason for my visit. I learned a lot about Elsa and the people she's living with. Some of the things I learned saddened me, and some profoundly shocked me. I was saddened by Elsa's story of herself. She is the only child of upper-middle-class parents. Her father is, or was, she hasn't been in touch with her family for more than a year, a speechwriter for one of the most powerful senators in Washington. Her mother is an attorney for a left-wing foundation whose principal activity is buying up houses in white suburban neighborhoods and moving black welfare families into them. Until she was 15, Elsa had been very happy. Her family had lived in Connecticut until then, and Elsa had attended an exclusive private school for girls. Single-sex schools are illegal now, of course. She spent the summers with her parents at their vacation home on the beach. Elsa's face glowed as she described the woods and trails around their summer home and the long walks she took by herself. She had her own little sailboat and often sailed out to a tiny island offshore for private picnics and long, happy hours of lying in the sun and daydreaming. Then the family moved to Washington, and her mother insisted that they take an apartment in a predominantly black neighborhood near Capitol Hill, rather than living in a white suburb. Elsa was one of only four white students at the junior high school to which they sent her. Elsa had developed early. Her natural warmth and open, uninhibited nature, combined with her outstanding physical charms, to produce a girl who had been extraordinarily attractive sexually even at 15. The result was that the black males, who also continually badgered the one other white girl at the school, gave Elsa no peace. The black girls, seeing this, hated Elsa with special passion and tormented her in every way they could. Elsa dared not go into the restroom or even let herself out of the sight of a teacher for a moment while she was at school. She soon found that the teachers offered no real protection when a black assistant principal cornered her in his office one day and tried to put his hand inside her dress. Each day, Elsa came home from school in tears and begged her parents to send her to another school. Her mother's response was to scream at her, slap her face, and call her a racist. If the black boys were bothering her, it was her fault, not theirs, and she should try harder to make friends with the black girls. Nor did her father offer her any comfort, even when she told him about the incident with the assistant principal. The whole issue embarrassed him, and he didn't want to hear about it. His liberalism was more passive than her mother's, but he was usually intimidated by his thoroughly liberated wife into going along on any matters that touched on race. Even when three young black thugs accosted him on his very doorstep, took his wallet and wristwatch, and then knocked him down and stomped on his eyeglasses, Elsa's mother wouldn't let him call the police and report the robbery. She regarded the very thought of filing a police complaint against blacks as somewhat fascist. Elsa stood it for 3 months, and then she ran away from home. She was taken in by the little commune she is with now, and, having a basically cheerful disposition, she learned to be tolerably happy in her new situation. Then, about a month ago, the trouble arose which led to my meeting her. A new girl, Mary Jane, had joined their group, and there was friction between Elsa and Mary Jane. The boy Elsa was sharing her mattress with at the time had apparently known Mary Jane earlier, before either joined the group, and Mary Jane regarded Elsa as a usurper. Elsa, in turn, resented Mary Jane's none-too-subtle efforts to entice her boyfriend away. The result was a screaming, clawing, hair-pulling fight between the two one day which Mary Jane, being the stronger, had won. Elsa had wandered the street for 2 days. That's when I met her. And then she had returned to the basement commune. Mary Jane, meanwhile, had gotten on the wrong side of another of the girls in the group, and Elsa pressed this advantage by issuing an ultimatum. Either Mary Jane must go, or she, Elsa, would leave permanently. Mary Jane had responded by threatening Elsa with a knife. "So what happened?" I asked. "We sold her," was Elsa's simple reply. "You sold her? What do you mean?" I exclaimed. Elsa explained. "Mary Jane refused to leave after everyone sided with me, so we sold her to Cappy the Kike. He gave us the TV and $200 for her." Cappy the Kike, it turned out, is a Jew named Kaplan who makes his living in the white slave trade. He makes regular trips to Washington from New York for the purpose of buying runaway girls. His usual suppliers are the wolf packs, from one of which I had rescued Elsa. These predatory groups snatch girls off the street, keep them for a week or so, and then if their disappearance has caused no comment in the newspapers, sell them to Kaplan. What happens to the girls after that, no one can say with certainty. But it is thought that most are confined in certain exclusive clubs in New York, where the wealthy go to satisfy strange and perverted appetites. Some, it is rumored, are eventually sold to a Satanist cult and painfully dismembered in gruesome rituals. Anyway, someone in the commune had heard that Kaplan was in town and buying, so when Mary Jane wouldn't leave, they tied her up, located Kaplan, and made the sale. I had thought I was unshockable, but I was horrified by Elsa's story of Mary Jane's fate. "How," I asked in a tone of outrage, "could you sell a white girl to a Jew?" Elsa was embarrassed by my obvious displeasure. She admitted that it was a terrible thing to have done and that she sometimes feels guilty when she thinks about Mary Jane. But it had seemed like a convenient solution to the commune's problem at the time. She offered the feeble excuse that it happens all the time, that the authorities apparently know all about it and don't interfere, and so it is really more society's fault than anyone's. I shook my head in disgust, but this turn of our conversation gave me a convenient opening to the topic in which I was mainly interested. A civilization which tolerates the existence of Kaplan and his filthy business should be burned to the ground, I said. We should make a bonfire of the whole thing and then start over fresh. I had unconsciously raised my voice loud enough for my last comment to be heard by everyone in the basement. A shaggy individual got up from his mattress in front of the TV and sauntered over. "What can anyone do?" he asked, not really expecting an answer. "Cappy the Kike's been arrested at least a dozen times, but the cops always turn him loose. He's got political connections. Some of the big Jews in New York are his customers, and I've heard that two or three congressmen go up there regularly to visit some of the clubs he supplies." "Then someone should blow up the Congress," I answered. "I guess that's already been tried," he laughed, apparently referring to the organization's mortar attack. "Well, if I had a bomb now, I'd try it myself," I said. "Where can I get some dynamite?" The fellow shrugged his shoulders and wandered back to his TV set. I then tried pumping Elsa for information. "Which groups in Georgetown have been doing bombings? How can I get in touch with one of them?" Elsa tried to be helpful, but she just didn't know. It was a subject in which she had no particular interest. Finally, she called out to the man who had strolled over earlier. "Harry, aren't the people over on 29th Street, the ones who call themselves Fourth World Liberation Front, into fighting the pigs?" Harry was obviously not pleased by her question. He jumped to his feet, glared fiercely at the two of us, and then stomped out of the basement without answering, slamming the door behind him. One of the women at the laundry sink turned around and reminded Elsa that it was her day to prepare the midday meal and that she hadn't even put the potatoes on the stove to boil yet. I squeezed Elsa's hand, wished her well, and made my exit. I guess I botched things rather badly. It was incredibly naive of me to imagine that I could just walk into the dropout community and be politely directed to someone engaged in violent and illegal activity against the system. Obviously, every undercover cop in Washington had been trying the same thing. Now the word must certainly be out everywhere that I'm a cop too. That blows any chance I may have had of making contact with anti-system militants in that particular milieu. Of course, we could send someone else over to try to find the Fourth World Liberation Front, whatever the hell it is. But I wonder now whether there's any point in that. My visit with Elsa has pretty well convinced me that, in the people who share her lifestyle, there's just not much potential for constructive collaboration with the organization. They lack self-discipline and any real sense of purpose. They've given up. All they really want to do is lie around all day screwing and smoking pot. I almost believe that if the government would double their welfare allowances, even the bomb throwers would lose their militants. Elsa is basically a good kid, and there must be a number of others whose instincts are mostly all right, but who just couldn't cope with this nightmare world, and so they dropped out. Although we both reject the world in its present condition and have both dropped out in a sense, the difference between the people in the organization and Elsa's friends is that we are capable of coping and they aren't. I cannot imagine myself or Henry or Catherine or anyone else in the organization just sitting around watching TV and letting the world go by when so much needs to be done. It's a difference of human quality. But there's more than one kind of quality that's important to us. Most Americans are still coping, some barely and some quite successfully. They haven't dropped out because they lack a certain sensitivity, a sensitivity which I believe we in the organization share with Elsa and the best of her friends, a sensitivity which allows us to smell the stink of this decaying society and which makes us gag. The copers out there, just like many of the non-copers, either can't smell the stink or it doesn't bother them. The Jews could lead them to any kind of pigsty at all, and as long as there was plenty of swill, they would adapt to it. Evolution has made skilled survivors of them, but it has failed them in another respect. How fragile a thing is man's civilization! How superficial it is to his basic nature! And upon how few of the teeming multitudes to whose lives it gives a pattern does it depend for its sustenance? Without the presence of perhaps 1 or 2% of the most capable individuals, the most aggressive, intelligent, and hardworking of our fellow citizens, I am convinced that neither this civilization nor any civilization could long sustain itself. It would gradually disintegrate, over centuries perhaps, and the people would not have the will or the energy or the genius to patch up the cracks. Eventually, all would return to the natural pre-civilized state, a state not too different from that of Georgetown's dropouts. But even energy and will and genius are not enough, clearly. America still has enough overachievers to keep the wheels turning. But these overachievers seem not to have noticed that the machine their exertions keep running long ago ran off the road and is now hurtling headlong into an abyss. They are insensitive to the ugliness and unnaturalness as well as to the ultimate danger of the direction they have taken. It is really only a minority of a minority which led our race out of the jungle and along the first few steps toward true civilization. We owe everything to those few of our ancestors who had both the sensitivity to feel what needed doing and the ability to do it. Without the sensitivity, no amount of ability can lead to truly great achievement. And without the ability, sensitivity leads only to daydreams and frustration. The organization has selected from the great mass of humanity those of our present generation who possess this rare combination. Now we must do whatever is necessary to prevail. The next diary entry is dated March 21st, 1993. Today, a new beginning. Quite a coincidence that it's the first day of spring. For me, it is like a return from the dead. 470 days of living death. To be back with Catherine, back with my other comrades, able to resume the struggle again after so much wasted time. The thought of these things fills me with an indescribable joy. So much has happened since my last entry in this diary. How glad I am that Catherine was able to save it for me. That it's difficult to decide how to condense it all here. Well, first things first. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning, pitch dark, a Sunday. We were all sound asleep. The first thing I remember is Catherine shaking me by the shoulder, trying to wake me up. I could hear an insistent buzzing in the background, which in my sleep-fogged condition, I assumed was our bedroom alarm clock. "Surely it's not time to get up yet," I mumbled. "It's the warning buzzer downstairs," Catherine whispered urgently. "Somebody's outside the building." That snapped me awake, but before I could even get my feet on the floor, there was a loud crash as something trailing a stream of sparks came hurtling through the carefully boarded-up bedroom window. Almost immediately, the room was filled with a choking cloud of gas, and I was gasping for breath in agony. The next couple of minutes are a little hazy in my memory. Somehow, we all got our gas masks on without turning on any lights. Bill and I raced downstairs, leaving Catherine and Carol to man the upstairs windows. Fortunately, no one had yet tried to enter the building, but as Bill and I reached the bottom of the stairs, we could hear someone outside with a bullhorn ordering us to come out with our hands up. I took a quick look through our peephole. The darkness outside had been turned bright as day by dozens of searchlights, all trained on our building. The glare kept me from seeing much of anything beyond the lights, but it was instantly clear that there were several hundred troops and policemen with lots of equipment out there. It was obviously futile to attempt to shoot our way out, but we laid down a brief barrage anyway, half a dozen quick shots each from the upstairs and downstairs windows, front and back, just to discourage the people outside from attempting to force a quick entry into the building. After that, we all stayed clear of the windows and doors, which were immediately riddled with a withering return fire, and concentrated on getting as much of our essential equipment out through our escape tunnel as we could. The cement block walls of the garage offered protection from the small arms fire being sprayed at us from every direction. Bill, Catherine, and Carol relayed our gear down the long, dark tunnel, while I stayed in the shop and gathered together for them the things I thought we should try to save. In a frantic and exhausting 3/4 of an hour, they assembled a small mountain of armaments and communications equipment in the drainage ditch at the far end of the tunnel. Although the three of them did most of the carrying, at least they were not in danger of being shot. I had bullets whistling around my ears the whole time, and I was stung at least a dozen times by splinters of concrete chipped from the walls by ricochets. I still don't understand how I avoided being killed. I even managed to fire a few rounds back through the door at our attackers every 5 minutes or so, just to keep them under cover. Finally, we had gotten out all our small arms and ammunition, about half our bulk explosives and heavier weapons, and all the completed communications units. Bill's tools were saved because he has the tidy habit of keeping them all together in a toolbox, but we abandoned most of my test equipment because it was scattered all over the shop. We huddled briefly in the grease pit and decided that Bill and the girls would steal a vehicle and load our things into it while I stayed in the shop and prepared a demolition charge that would cover the entrance of our escape tunnel. I would give them 30 minutes, then I would light the fuse and make my own exit. Catherine broke away and ran quickly back upstairs, where she grabbed some of our personal items, including my diary, and then I shooed her back into the tunnel with the others for the last time. The downstairs doors and the boards over the windows were about half shot away by this time, and so much light was coming into the shop from the searchlights that any movement was becoming extremely hazardous. Working with nervous haste, I assembled a 20-pound charge of Tritonol in the grease pit just above the tunnel entrance and primed it. Then I crawled along the floor, heading for the wall where approximately another 100 pounds of Tritonol was stacked in small containers. I intended to run a length of Primacord from that batch to the charge in the grease pit so that the whole shop would go up in one blast, thoroughly covering everything in rubble. It would take the cops a couple of days to sift through the debris and discover that we had escaped. But I never made it to the wall. Somehow, I still don't understand exactly what happened. The charge in the grease pit exploded prematurely. Perhaps a ricocheting bullet hit the primer. Or perhaps sparks from one of the tear gas grenades, which were still being lobbed into the place, ignited the fuse. In any event, the concussion knocked me cold and very nearly killed me. I regained consciousness on an operating table in a hospital emergency room. The next few days were extraordinarily painful ones. I wince at the memory. I was taken directly from the emergency room to an interrogation cell in the sub-basement of the FBI building, which was still only partially cleared of the rubble from our bombing 7 weeks earlier. Although I was still disoriented and in extreme pain from my wounds, I was handled very roughly. My wrists were tightly handcuffed behind me, and I was kicked and punched whenever I stumbled or failed to respond fast enough to an order. Forced to stand in the center of the cell while half a dozen FBI agents shouted questions at me from all sides, I could hardly do more than mumble incoherently, even if I had wanted to cooperate with them. Even in my agony, however, I felt a surge of elation when I realized from my interrogator's questions that the others must have gotten away safely. Over and over again, the men around me screamed out the same question. Where are the others? How many were in the building with you? How did they get out? Apparently, the charge in the grease pit had successfully obliterated the tunnel entrance. The questions were punctuated with repeated slaps and kicks until I finally sagged to the floor, mercifully unconscious again. When I came to, I was still lying where I had fallen, on the bare concrete floor. The light was on, no one else was in the room, and I could hear the chattering of pneumatic hammers and other sounds being made by repairmen working in the corridor beyond my cell door. I ached all over, with the handcuffs causing me particular agony, but my head was nearly clear. My first thought was one of regret that I no longer had my poison capsule. The secret police, of course, had taken my little necklace away as soon as they had found my unconscious body in the wreckage of the garage. I cursed myself for having failed to take the precaution of carrying the capsule in my mouth before the explosion. Probably it wouldn't have been found there, and I could have bitten it as soon as I woke up in the hospital. In the days to come, this regret was to recur again and again. My second thought was also one of regret and self-recrimination. I was tormented by a suspicion so strong that it nearly amounted to certainty that my ill-advised visit to Elsa 2 days earlier was responsible for my predicament. Evidently, someone from Elsa's group had followed me home and then had informed on me. The suspicion was later confirmed indirectly by my captors. I was alone with my aches and somber thoughts for only a few minutes before my second interrogation session began. This time, two FBI agents came into my cell, followed by a physician and three other men, two of the last three being large, muscular-looking Negroes. The third man was a stooped, white-haired figure of about 70. A nasty little smile flickered around the corners of his coarse-looking mouth, which occasionally split into a leering grin, revealing the gold caps on his tobacco-stained teeth. After the physician had quickly checked me over, pronounced me reasonably fit and left, the two FBI agents jerked me to my feet and then took up positions near the door. The session was turned over to the sinister-looking fellow with the gold teeth. Speaking with a thick Hebrew accent and a disarmingly mild professorial manner, he introduced himself to me as Colonel Saul Rubin of Israeli Military Intelligence. Before I could even wonder what business a representative of a foreign government had questioning me, Rubin explained, "Since your racist activities are in violation of the International Genocide Convention, Mr. Turner, you will be tried by an international tribunal with representatives from both your country and mine. But first, we need some information from you.
so that we can bring also your fellow criminals to justice at the same time. I understand that you were not very cooperative last night. Let me warn you that it will go very hard with you if you fail to answer my questions. I have had a great deal of experience over the last 45 years in extracting information from people who did not wish to cooperate with me. In the end, they all told me everything I wanted to know, both the Arabs and the Germans. But it was a very unpleasant experience for those who were stubborn. Then, after a brief pause, ah yes, some of those Germans back in 1945 and 1946, particularly the ones from the SS, were quite stubborn. The apparently satisfying recollection brought another hideous grin to Reuben's face, and I could not suppress a shudder. I remembered the horrible photographs one of our members, who was a former Army intelligence officer, had shown me years ago of German prisoners who had had their eyes gouged out, their teeth pulled, their fingers cut off, and their testicles smashed by sadistic interrogators, many wearing U.S. Army uniforms, prior to their conviction and execution by military courts as war criminals. I wanted nothing so much as to be able to smash the leering Jewish face before me with my fists, but my handcuffs would not permit me that luxury. I settled for spitting into Reuben's face and simultaneously aiming a kick at his crotch. Unfortunately, my stiff, aching muscles ruined my aim, and my kick only caught Reuben's thigh, sending him staggering back a couple of paces. Then the two Negro orderlies seized me. Under Reuben's instructions, they proceeded to give me a vicious, thorough, and scientific beating. When they finished, my whole body was a throbbing, searing mass of pain, and I was writhing on the floor, whimpering. The subsequent interrogation sessions were worse, much worse. Because a public show trial was planned for me, presumably in the Adolf Eichmann manner, Reuben avoided the eye gouging and finger cutting, which would have disfigured me, but the things he did were fully as painful. At this point is inserted an editorial note to the reader. Adolf Eichmann was a middle-level German official during World War II. 15 years after the war, in the year 39 before the new era, he was kidnapped in South America by Jews, flown to Israel, and made the central figure in an elaborately staged 2-year propaganda campaign to evoke sympathy from the non-Jewish world for Israel, the only haven for persecuted Jews. After fiendish torture, Eichmann was displayed in a soundproof glass cage during a 4-month show trial in which he was condemned to death for crimes against the Jewish people. Here the text resumes. For days at a time, I was completely out of my mind, and, as Reuben had predicted, I eventually told him everything he wanted to know. No human being could have done otherwise. During the torture sessions, the two FBI agents who were always present as spectators sometimes turned a bit pale, and when Reuben had his two black assistants thrust a long, blunt rod up into my rectum so that I was screaming and wriggling like a skewered pig, one looked as if he were going to be sick, but they never raised an objection. I guess it was much the same after World War II, when American officers of German descent calmly watched Jewish torturers work over their racial brothers who had been in the German army, and likewise saw nothing amiss when Negro GIs raped and brutalized German girls. Is it that they have been so brainwashed by the Jews that they hate their own race? Or is it that they are just insensitive bastards who will do whatever they're told as long as they keep drawing their salaries? Despite Reuben's exquisitely painful expertise, I am now thoroughly convinced that the organization's interrogation techniques are much more effective than the system's. We are scientific, whereas the system is merely brutal. Although Reuben broke my resistance and got answers to his questions, fortunately he failed to ask many of the right questions. When he had finally finished with me, after nearly a month-long nightmare,
I had told him the names of most of the members of the organization that I knew, the locations of their hideouts, and who had been involved in various operations against the system. I had described in detail the preparation for the bombing of the FBI building and my role in the mortar assault on the Capitol. And, of course, I explained exactly how the other members of my unit had escaped capture. All these disclosures certainly caused problems for the organization. But since they were able to anticipate exactly what the political police would learn from me, they were able to nullify any potential damage. Mainly it meant hastily abandoning several perfectly good hideouts and establishing new ones. But Rubin's interrogation technique elicited only information in the form of answers to direct questions. He asked me nothing about our communications system, and so he found out nothing about it. As I learned later, our legals inside the FBI kept the organization informed as to just what information my interrogation was yielding, so we retained confidence in the security of our radio communications. He also found out nothing about the order or about our philosophy or long-range goals, which knowledge might have helped the system understand our strategy. As it was, everything Rubin got from me was of a tactical nature only. I believe the reason for this to be the system's arrogant assumption that the task of liquidating the organization would be a matter of only weeks. We were regarded as a major problem, but not as a mortal danger. After my period of interrogation was over, I was kept in the FBI building for another 3 weeks, apparently in anticipation of having me handy to identify various organization members who might be arrested on the basis of the information I had furnished. None were arrested during this time, however, and I was eventually transferred to the special prison compound at Fort Belvoir, where nearly 200 other organization members and about the same number of our legals were being held. The government was afraid to put us into ordinary prisons because of the danger that the organization might free us, and also, I suspect, because they were afraid we might indoctrinate other white prisoners. So all captured organization members were taken to Fort Belvoir from all over the country and kept in solitary confinement cells in buildings surrounded by barbed wire, tanks, guard towers with machine guns, and two companies of military policemen, all in the center of an army base. And there I spent the next 14 months. What happened to the plans for my trial, I cannot say. Many people consider solitary confinement to be especially harsh treatment, but it was a blessing for me. I was still in such a depressed and abnormal frame of mind, partly the result of Rubin's torture, partly from a sense of guilt at having yielded to that torture, and partly just from being locked up and unable to participate in the struggle, that I needed some time alone to straighten myself out again. And, of course, it was nice not to have to worry about blacks, which would have been a real curse in any ordinary prison. No one who has not been subjected to the terror and agony to which I was can understand the profound and lasting effect of such an experience. My body has healed completely now, and I have recovered from the peculiar combination of depression and nervous jitters with which my interrogation left me. But I am not the same man I was. I am more impatient now, more serious-minded, even somber, perhaps, more determined than ever to get on with our task. And I have lost all fear of death. I have not become more reckless, less so, if anything. But nothing holds any terror for me now. I can be much harder on myself than before, and also harder on others when necessary. Woe betide any whining conservative, responsible or otherwise, who gets in the way of our revolution when I am around. I will listen to no more excuses from these self-serving collaborators, but will simply reach for my pistol. All the time I and the others were at Fort Belvoir, we were supposed to be incommunicado and were allowed no reading material, newspapers or otherwise. Nevertheless, we soon learned how to communicate to a limited extent with one another, and we established an oral news pipeline from the outside through our guards, who were not an altogether unsympathetic lot. The news we all wanted to hear, of course, was of the war between the organization and the system. We were especially cheered up whenever there was news of a successful action against the system, an atrocity in the jargon of the news media, and we became depressed if the period between news of major actions stretched to more than a few days. As time passed, news of actions did become increasingly less frequent, and the media began predicting with greater and greater confidence the imminent liquidation of the remnants of the organization and the return of the country to normalcy. That worried us, but our worry was tempered by the observation that fewer and fewer new prisoners were joining us at Fort Belvoir. An average of one a day was being brought in when I first went there, but that number had declined to less than one a week by August of last year. Then came the great Houston bombings of September 11th and 12th, 1992. In two earth-shaking days, there were 14 major bombings, which left more than 4,000 persons dead and much of Houston's industrial and shipping facilities smoldering wreckage. The action began when a fully loaded munitions ship carrying aerial bombs to Israel detonated in the crowded Houston ship channel in the pre-dawn hours of September 11th. That ship took four others to the bottom of the channel with her, thoroughly blocking it, and also set fire to an enormous refinery nearby. Within an hour, eight other massive explosions had occurred along the ship channel, putting the nation's second busiest port out of business for more than 4 months. Five later explosions closed the Houston airport, destroyed the city's main power-generating station, and collapsed two strategically located overpasses and a bridge, making two of the most heavily traveled freeways in the area impassable. Houston became an instant disaster area, and the federal government rushed in thousands of troops, as much to keep an angry and panic-stricken public under control as to counter the organization. The Houston action won us no friends, but neither did it help the government's case, and it thoroughly dispelled the growing notion that our revolution had been stifled. And, after Houston, there was Wilmington, then Providence, then Racine. Actions were fewer than before, but they were much, much bigger. It became apparent to us last fall that the revolution had entered a new and more decisive phase, but more of that later. Last night was the most important action of all for those of us at Fort Belvoir. Just before midnight, as usual, two olive-drab buses pulled up in front of the gate to our prison compound. Ordinarily, they bring in about 60 MPs for the midnight guard shift and take away the evening shift. This time it was different. My first inkling that a breakout was in progress came when I was wakened by the sound of a machine gun being fired from one of the guard towers. It was quickly silenced by a direct hit from the 105-millimeter gun on one of the four tanks in our compound. After that, there was intermittent small-arms fire and a lot of shouting and the sound of running feet. Finally, the wooden door of my cell burst inward under the blow of a sledgehammer, and I was free. I was one of the lucky 150 or so who squeezed into the two MP buses and rode out in them. Several dozen others clung to the outside of the four captured tanks, whose inattentive crews had been the first targets of our rescuers. The rest had to go on foot, slogging through a downpour which providentially kept the Army's helicopters grounded. Altogether, we lost 18 prisoners and four rescuers killed, and 61 prisoners recaptured. But 442 of us, according to the news report on the radio, made it to the waiting trucks outside the base, while the tanks kept our pursuers at bay. That wasn't the end of the excitement, but let it suffice to say that by 4 o'clock this morning, we had successfully dispersed to more than two dozen preselected safe houses in the Washington area. After a few hours' rest, I slipped into a set of civilian work clothes, took the set of false identification cards that had been carefully and masterfully prepared for me, and, carrying a newspaper and a lunch pail, made my way among the morning job goers to the rendezvous point I was assigned. Within 2 minutes, a pickup truck carrying a man and a woman pulled up to the curb beside me. The door opened, and I squeezed in. As Bill drove off into the rush hour traffic, I held my beloved Catherine in my arms once again. The next entry is dated March 24th, 1993. Today I was tried on the charge of oath-breaking, the most serious offense with which a member of the order can be charged. It was a harrowing experience, but I knew it was coming, and I am enormously relieved to have it behind me despite the outcome. All during the months in my prison cell, I agonized over the question. Did I, by failing to kill myself before I was captured, break my oath to the order? I must have reviewed in my mind 100 times the circumstances of my capture and the subsequent events, trying to convince myself that my behavior had been blameless, that I had fallen alive into the hands of my captors through no fault of my own. Today I related the whole sequence of events to a jury of my peers. The summons came this morning by way of radio, and I knew immediately what it was for, although I was surprised at the address to which I was ordered to report, one of the newest and largest office buildings in downtown Washington. As an attractive receptionist ushered me into a conference room in a large suite of law offices, my apprehension was mixed with gratitude for the 3-day period of recuperation I had been allowed since the breakout. I had just slipped into the robe which I found waiting for me on a coat rack when another door opened and 8 other robed and hooded figures walked into the room and silently took seats around a large table. The last of the 8 had his hood pushed back, and I recognized the familiar features of Major Williams. The proceedings were brisk and bathed in an air of formality. After a little more than an hour of questioning, I was told to wait in a smaller adjoining room. I waited there for nearly 3 hours. When the others had finally finished discussing my case and had reached a decision, I was summoned back into the conference room. While I stood at one end of the table, Major Williams, seated at the other end, announced the verdict. His words, to the extent I can remember them, were as follows. Earl Turner, we have weighed your performance as a member of this order on 2 grounds, and we have found you wanting on both. First, in your conduct immediately prior to the police raid in which you were seized and imprisoned, you gave evidence of a shocking lack of maturity and sound judgment. Your indiscretion in visiting the girl in Georgetown, an act which, although not specifically forbidden, was not within the realm of your assigned duties, led directly to a situation in which you and the members of your unit were placed in extreme jeopardy, and a valuable facility was lost to the organization. Because of this failure of judgment on your part, your period as a probationary member of the order is being extended for 6 months. Furthermore, your time as a prisoner will not count as a part of your probation. Therefore, you will not be permitted the right of union before March of next year at the earliest. We find, however, that your conduct prior to the police raid does not constitute a violation of your oath. I breathed an inaudible sigh of relief upon hearing this last statement. But then Williams continued with a grimmer note in his voice. The fact that you were taken alive by the political police and remained alive during nearly a month of interrogation is a far more serious matter. In swearing your oath, you consecrated your life to the service of the order. You undertook to place your duty to the order ahead of all other things, including the preservation of your life at all times. You accepted this obligation willingly and with the knowledge that, for the duration of our struggle, it entails a very substantial possibility of your actually having to give up your life in order to avoid breaking your oath. And you were specifically warned against falling alive into the hands of the political police and were given the means to avoid this. Yet you did fall into their hands and remained alive. The information they extracted from you seriously hampered the work of the organization in this area and placed many of your comrades in very grave danger. We understand, of course, that you did not make a conscious decision to violate your oath. We have carefully looked into the circumstances of your capture and we are aware of the interrogation techniques the political police now use against our people. If you were merely a soldier in any other army in the world, you would be held blameless. But the order is not like any other army. We have claimed for ourselves the right to decide the fate of all our people, and eventually to rule the world in accord with our principles. If we are to be worthy of this right, then we must be willing to accept the responsibility which goes with it. Each day we make decisions and carry out actions which result in the deaths of white persons, many of them innocent of any offense which we consider punishable. We are willing to take the lives of these innocent persons because a much greater harm will ultimately befall our people if we fail to act now. Our criterion is the ultimate good of our race. We can apply no lesser criterion to ourselves. Indeed, we must be much sterner with ourselves than with others. We must maintain for ourselves a standard of conduct much higher than we demand of the general public or even of ordinary members of the organization. In particular, we must never accept the idea, born of the sickness of our era, that a good excuse for non-performance of a duty is a satisfactory substitute for performance. For us, there can be no excuses. Either we perform our duty or we do not. If we do not, we need no excuse. We simply accept the responsibility for failure. And if there is a penalty, we accept that too. The penalty for oath-breaking is death. The room was perfectly still, but I could hear a buzzing in my ears, and the floor seemed to sway under my feet. I stood in stunned silence until Williams began speaking again, this time in a somewhat softer voice. "The duty of this tribunal is clear, Earl Turner. We must act in your case in such a way that every member of this order who may, at some time in the future, find himself in circumstances similar to yours during the police raid on your headquarters, will know that death is inevitable if he cannot avoid capture, either an honorable death by his own hand, or a less than honorable death at the hands of his comrades later. There must be no temptation for him to avoid his duty in the hope that a good excuse later will preserve his life. Some of us here today have argued that this consideration, setting a firm example for others, should be the sole determinant of your fate. But others of us have argued that, because you had not yet achieved full membership in this order at the time in question, because you had not yet participated in the rite of union, your conduct can be reasonably judged by a different standard than would be applied to someone who had completed his probationary period and achieved union. Our decision has not been easy, but now you must hear it and you must abide by it. First, you must satisfactorily complete your extended period of probation. Then, at some time after the end of that period, you will be permitted union, but only on a conditional basis, something we have never allowed before. The condition will be that you undertake a mission whose successful completion can reasonably be expected to result in your death. Unfortunately, we are all too often presented with the painful task of assigning such suicide missions to our members when we can find no other way to achieve a necessary goal. In your case, such a mission will serve two ends. If you complete it successfully, the act of completion will remove the condition from your union. Then, even though you die, you will continue to live in us and in our successors for as long as our order endures, just as with any other member who achieves union and then loses his life. And if, by some chance, you should survive your mission, you may then take your place in our ranks with no stain on your record. Do you understand everything I have said?" I nodded and answered, "Yes, I understand, and I accept your judgment without reservation. It is just and proper. I have never expected to survive the struggle in which we are now engaged, and I am grateful that I will be allowed to make a further contribution to it. I am also grateful that the prospect of union remains before me. The next diary entry is dated March 25th. Today Henry came over, and he, Bill, and I had a long talk. Henry is heading for the West Coast tomorrow, and he wanted to help Bill fill me in on the developments of the past year before he leaves. Apparently, he will be engaged in training new recruits and handling some of the organization's other internal functions in the Los Angeles area, where we are especially strong. When he greeted me, he showed me the sign, and I knew that he had also become a member of the order. In essence, what I learned today is what I had already concluded in my prison cell. The organization has shifted the main thrust of its attacks from tactical personal targets to strategic economic targets. We are no longer trying to destroy the system directly, but are now concentrating on undermining the general public's support for the system. I have felt for a long time that this change is necessary. Apparently, two things forced Revolutionary Command to the same conclusion. The fact that we were not recruiting enough new members to make up our losses in the war of attrition against the system, and the fact that neither our blows against the system nor the system's increasingly repressive responses to those blows were having any really decisive effect on the public's attitude toward the system. The first factor was mandatory. We simply could not keep up our level of activity against the system as our casualties steadily mounted, even if we wanted to. Henry estimated that the total number of our frontline combat troops for the whole country, those ready and able to use knife, gun, or bomb against the system, had declined to a low point of about 400 persons last summer. Our frontline troops make up only about a fourth of the organization's membership, and they have been suffering a greatly disproportionate casualty rate. So the organization was forced to de-escalate the level of the war temporarily, while we still preserved a strong enough nucleus for another approach. Our whole strategy against the system was failing. It was failing because the great bulk of white Americans were not responding to the situation in the way we had hoped they would. That is, we had counted on a positive, imitative response to our propaganda of the deed, but it was not forthcoming. We had hoped that when we set the example of resisting the system's tyranny, others would resist too. We had hoped that by making dramatic strikes against top system personalities and important system facilities, we would inspire Americans everywhere to initiate similar actions of their own. But, for the most part, the bastards just sat on their asses. Sure, a dozen or so synagogues were burned, and there was an overall rise in the level of politically motivated violence, but it was generally misdirected and ineffective. Without organization, such activities have little value unless they are very widespread and can be sustained over a long period. And the system's response to the organization irritated many people and caused a lot of grumbling, but it didn't even come close to provoking a rebellion. Tyranny, we have discovered, just isn't all that unpopular among the American people. What is really precious to the average American is not his freedom or his honor or the future of his race, but his paycheck. He complained when the system began busing his kids to black schools 20 years ago, but he was allowed to keep his station wagon and his fiberglass speedboat, so he didn't fight. He complained when they took away his guns 5 years ago, but he still had his color TV and his backyard barbecue, so he didn't fight. And he complains today when the blacks rape his women at will and the system makes him show an identity pass to buy groceries or pick up his laundry. But he still has a full belly most of the time, so he won't fight. He hasn't an idea in his head that wasn't put there by his TV set. He desperately wants to be well-adjusted and to do and think and say exactly what he thinks is expected of him. He has become, in short, just what the system has been trying to make of him these past 50 years or so, a mass man, a member of the great brainwashed proletariat, a herd animal, a true Democrat. That, unfortunately, is our average white American. We can wish that it weren't so, but it is. The plain, horrible truth is that we have been trying to evoke a heroic spirit of idealism which just isn't there anymore. It has been washed right out of 99% of our people by the flood of Jewish materialist propaganda in which they have been submerged practically all their lives. As for the last 1%, there are various reasons why they aren't doing us much good. Some, of course, are too ornery to work within the confines of the organization or any organized group. They can only do their own thing, as a number, in fact, are. The others may still have different ideas of their own, or they simply may not have been able to make contact with us since we were forced underground. Eventually, we could recruit most of these, but we no longer have the time. What the organization began doing about 6 months ago is treating Americans realistically for the first time, namely like a herd of cattle. Since they are no longer capable of responding to an idealistic appeal, we began appealing to things that they can understand, fear and hunger. We will take the food off their tables and empty their refrigerators. We will rob the system of its principal hold over them. And when they begin getting hungry, we will make them fear us more than they fear the system. We will treat them exactly the way they deserve to be treated. I don't know why we held back from this approach for so long. We have had the example of decades of guerrilla warfare in Africa, Asia, and Latin America to instruct us. In every case, the guerrillas won by making the people fear them, not love them. By publicly torturing to death village leaders who opposed them, and by carrying out brutal massacres of entire village populations which refused to feed them, they inspired such terror in neighboring villages that everyone was afraid to refuse them what they asked. We Americans observed all this, but failed to apply the lesson to ourselves. We regarded, correctly, all those non-whites as mere herds of animals, and were not surprised that they behaved as they did. But we regarded ourselves, incorrectly, as something better. There was a time when we were better, and we are fighting to ensure that there will be such a time again. But for now, we are merely a herd, being manipulated through our basis instincts by a pack of clever aliens. We have sunk to the point where we no longer hate our oppressors or try to fight them. We merely fear them and attempt to curry favor with them. So be it. We will suffer grievously for having allowed ourselves to fall under the Jewish spell. We stopped wasting our resources in small-scale terror attacks and shifted to large-scale attacks on carefully selected economic targets, power stations, fuel depots, transportation facilities, food sources, key industrial plants. We do not expect to bring down the already creaky American economic structure immediately, but we do expect to cause a number of localized and temporary breakdowns, which will gradually have a cumulative effect on the whole public. Already a sizable portion of the public has been made to realize that it will not be allowed to sit back and watch the war on TV in safety and comfort. In Houston, for example, hundreds of thousands went for nearly 2 weeks without electricity last September. The food in their refrigerators and freezers quickly spoiled, as did the perishables in their supermarkets. There were two major food riots by hungry Houstonians before the army was able to set up enough relief stations to handle everyone. In one instance, federal troops shot 26 persons in a mob trying to storm a government food depot. And then the organization got another riot started with the rumor that the emergency rations the government was handing out were contaminated with botulism. Houston isn't back to normal yet, with most of the city still subject to a staggered 6-hour-a-day power blackout. In Wilmington, we put half the city on the dole by blowing up two big DuPont plants, and we turned the lights off for half of New England when we knocked out that power-generating station just outside Providence. The electronics manufacturer we hit in Racine wasn't very big, but he was a sole supplier of certain key components for other manufacturers all across the country.